From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the U.S. prisoner swap, Israel condemning plans for a Palestinian unity government, revolutionaries remaining in Kiev's Independence Square, plus some perspective on what's happening in Nigeria. Here in Washington on Sunday, President Obama praised the release of Bo Bergdahl, the American soldier released Saturday after nearly 5 years of captivity in Afghanistan in a Taliban prisoner exchange. We get more now from White House correspondent Luis Ramirez.
President Obama appeared in the White House Rose Garden, joined by the parents of the 28-year-old U.S. Army sergeant, for an emotional announcement.
He wasn't forgotten by his community in Idaho or the military, which rallied to support the Bergdahls through thick and thin. And he wasn't forgotten by his country, because the United States of America does not ever leave our men and women in uniform behind.
The soldier's father, Bob Bergdahl, began his statement with words from a Muslim prayer, noting that his son had picked up Pashto, the language of his captors, and may not have heard much English spoken for a long time.
I'd like to say to Bo right now, who's having trouble speaking English, Bismillah Rahman Rahim, Zayabayem. I'm your father, Bo. The people of Afghanistan, the same. Khalifa Al Thani, the complicated nature of this recovery will never really be comprehended.
Bergdahl's release is the result of an agreement brokered by the Emir of Qatar, whom Mr. Obama thanked.
As part of this effort, the United States is transferring 5 detainees from the prison in Guantanamo Bay to Qatar. The Qatari government has given us assurances that it will put in place measures to protect our national security.
Republican Senator John McCain welcomed Sergeant Bergdahl's release but questioned the prisoner swap. The senator has asked the Obama administration to disclose exactly what measures are being taken to ensure the 5 men, Taliban leaders whom McCain described as hardened terrorists and vicious and violent extremists, never return to fight against the United States and its partners. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Washington.
Israel has condemned Palestinian plans to inaugurate a controversial new government this week. Robert Berger reporting now from the VOA Jerusalem Bureau.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called on the international community not to recognize the new Palestinian unity government that is due to be formed on Monday. The new government includes the secular Palestinian Authority that controls much of the West Bank and the rival Islamic militant group Hamas that rules the Gaza Strip. Speaking at the weekly cabinet meeting in Jerusalem, Mr. Netanyahu said the world must not embrace this government. Hamas is a terrorist organization that seeks Israel's destruction, he said. Such a government would not bolster peace, Mr. Netanyahu said. It would strengthen terror. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas decided to end a 7-year rift with Hamas after peace talks with Israel collapsed a month ago. Hamas opposes peace negotiations and does not recognize Israel's right to exist. But Mr. Abbas says his peace policies will remain the official position of the government. Palestinian chief negotiator Saab Barakat says it is a golden opportunity to bring Hamas into the peace process.
You have an opportunity to have one authority, one gun, the rule of law, a government with a program of 2 states, recognizing Israel, renouncing violence.
President Abbas says Israel has already informed him that it will boycott the new Palestinian government. Like Israel, the United States considers Hamas to be a terrorist organization. But America is taking a wait-and-see approach. The State Department says it will study the composition of the new government and then determine if it is one that the U.S. can work with or not. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
U.S. State Department has confirmed that an American carried out the May 25th suicide bombing in Syria, and as VOA's Kent Klein reports, it is believed to be the first time a U.S. citizen has been involved in an attack of this kind as part of the Syrian civil war.
State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki confirmed Friday that the man's name was Moner Mohammed Abu Salha.
I can confirm that this individual was a U.S. citizen involved in a suicide bombing in Syria. We don't have further information beyond that to share at this time.
Abu Salha, who had lived in the U.S. state of Florida, was identified as the man who launched Sunday's truck bombing outside a restaurant where Syrian government troops gathered in the government-held northwestern city of Idlib. Opposition forces said he was a U.S. citizen who called himself Abu Huraira al-Amriki. The name al-Amriki means the American. It's not known how many people died in the bombing. Abu Salha was identified as having taken part in activities with the al-Qaeda-linked insurgency group Nusra Front. That group and the Islamic Front Sukkur al-Sham claimed responsibility for the blast. Psaki says it's difficult for the U.S. to measure how many foreign fighters are taking part in Syria's three-year civil war.
We are concerned about the flow of foreign fighters into and out of Syria. It's difficult to provide that level of analysis or a precise figure, but we're engaged in a focused outreach effort with key partner governments regarding our shared concern of the flow of foreign fighters to the Syrian conflict.
Opposition rebels said Abu Salha's truck was loaded with 16 tons of explosives, headed for the Al-Fanar restaurant. It was one of four truck bombings that day in Idlib province. At least 160,000 people have died in fighting between government forces and opposition groups trying to remove Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from power. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
Turkish security forces moved on protesters in a public square in Istanbul on the anniversary of last year's anti-government demonstrations. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said if the protesters go there to that public square, they'll face the consequences because security forces have clear orders to do everything possible to keep order. Police used tear gas and water cannons Saturday to push demonstrators back at Istanbul's Taksim Square. The protest echoes gatherings in Turkey's main cities last year when demonstrations against development plans for a park turned into marches against government authoritarianism.
Each week on Daybreak Asia, we cover the stories of women who are working to change the world.
She was locked up by her family when she reached puberty, which happens to all the Muslim girls in her village. And she then went on to become a politician and an activist, and she's an all-round amazing person, really.
I'm Frances Alonso, producer of Women Rising. Listen for my reports about the empowerment of women around the world on Daybreak Asia and on the web at voanews.com.
Ukrainian activists who fought for change in Kiev's independent square, also known as the Maidan, are refusing to leave the public space that became the focal point of protest in February. For members of the self-defense group from the Ukrainian city of Odessa, the revolution is not over. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports on what the future might hold for Independent Square and those who occupy it as the new government takes charge.
Defying orders to tear down one of the many barricades still blocking the roads in downtown Kiev, they say they will stay until they are sure the political reforms they fought for have taken hold. One fighter, Kostya, said he gave up everything for the fight and is not ready to go back.
I lost my job. I have separated from my family. I left Odessa, and I did not leave for nothing. I left to fight for my motherland so that Ukraine will be united.
They came from across Ukraine in bands called Hundreds to defend the revolution, setting up tents and barriers in Kyiv's Maidan, or Independence Square. Stacks of bricks and tires remain from the February protests that forced the ousting of Russian-backed leader Viktor Yanukovych. A new president, Petro Poroshenko, is set to take office this week. Meantime, the country's attention has turned toward the smoldering battle with pro-Russian separatists in the east, and the government has asked citizens to join the fight. Some activists in Maidan say they support the cause, but are not going anywhere. Konstantin Klimenchenko heads a civilian group that cooked meals throughout the protests.
There will be certain rotation. People from the east will come here to rest, and people from here will go there to fight. And we will just keep feeding them.
The Maidan serves another role, as a living memorial. The streets are lined with a growing number of dedications to some 100 protesters killed in battles with police, a group known from now on as the Heavenly Hundred. In their memory, some activists want to establish the square as a center for continued political discussion. Ivan Kukurudziak says those who gave their lives fought for more than just a change of leadership.
Because when Yanukovych left, it was just the process, it was not the win. Poroshenko became a president, it's not the win, it's just a process. So Maidan should be a place of activism, of innovations and propositions until the dreams of people who died will come true.
Kukurudziak wants to see a permanent place here for the organizations that supported the cause. But not everyone agrees that Maidan should stay. Anita, a medical student, helped injured protesters during the demonstrations. She says the square has already served its purpose.
I think that right now Maidan is not needed, and if people will need it, they will come out again. Now I do not think Maidan is playing any role.
The city is ready to move on, and the new mayor has called for Maidan to be cleared. But it may be harder to convince those who believe, or who want to believe, that there's still a battle here to be fought. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Kyiv.
And turning to the situation in Nigeria, where President Goodluck Jonathan has vowed to do everything possible to rescue more than 200 schoolgirls who were kidnapped last month by the Islamist insurgents known as Boko Haram. He made the promise during a speech marking the 15th anniversary of the end of military rule in Nigeria. Boko Haram has been carrying out an insurgency for 5 years in which thousands of people have been killed and an estimated 750,000 Nigerians have been driven from their homes. President Jonathan also used his speech last week to promise he would address poverty that helps to fuel the Boko Haram uprising, but only once the insurgency is put down, he says. The World Bank says two-thirds of the 170 million Nigerians are struggling with poverty, and it happens in Africa's biggest oil producer. For some perspective on Mr. Jonathan's speech and the government's efforts to deal with Boko Haram, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two scholars. J. Peter Pham is director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center, and Lauren Plock-Blanchard is an Africa analyst at the Congressional Research Service, which is an arm of the U.S. Library of Congress. Pham reacts first.
It shows how much still needs to be done in Nigeria. Nothing justifies the outrage that Boko Haram perpetrated by kidnapping these schoolgirls who are taking their exams. On the other hand, Boko Haram didn't arise in isolation. It grew up out of years of political, economic, social marginalization, neglect of most of the north, but in particular the northeastern part of Nigeria. It grew up out of a heavy-handed government attempt to quash it by force alone without dealing with basic questions of human security and development. And so it continues to feed off of these ineffectual, heavy-handed tactics on the part of the Nigerian government, one which has yet to really come to terms with the insurgency it's facing and the challenges which it needs to confront once and for all if it really is serious about ending this plague, which really has victimized Nigerians.
Turning to you, Lauren Plock-Blanchard, for your reaction to the speech, and based on what Peter Pham just said, it doesn't sound like perhaps the Nigerian government quite gets it yet. This talk about a total war against terrorism doesn't seem to indicate that they understand that there are serious underlying problems. How do you see it?
This is a big question, you know, and it's something I think that international community has been asking itself since the kidnapping occurred, and certainly since the hashtag campaign and the social media focus has really drawn a lot of attention to the Nigerian government's or lack thereof to counter Boko Haram. And this is not to say that they haven't been putting extra forces up to the fight. They've had a joint task force operating in the north, I think, that dates back to about 2011. They enhanced it in 2013 when President Jonathan declared the state of emergency for the three states that have been most affected by Boko Haram operations. But we haven't necessarily seen the Nigerian military setting itself up for success up there. Their procurement over the last 5 or more years since Boko Haram's insurgency has really expanded and taken hold of the Northeast, they haven't been setting themselves up to fight a counterinsurgency campaign. They've been largely continuing to buy things and focus on their naval operations, for example, down in the Niger Delta, dealing with Niger Delta militancy prior to the amnesty, dealing with attacks that are ongoing against oil installations, kidnapping of oil workers. Obviously, they are still trying to maintain their peacekeeping operations abroad, but they haven't been necessarily doing the sorts of things and developing the sort of strategy that one needs to fight a counterinsurgency at home.
Back to you, Peter Pham. We've, of course, been talking about this problem at these microphones for years now, although it has now just sort of captured international attention here in the United States. Why do you think the Nigerian government has been unable to stop the growth and evolution of Boko Haram?
I think there are several factors, not one of which explains everything, but I think together they form a picture. One is President Goodluck Jonathan's agenda, insofar as a program for his administration, has been focused heavily on questions of development in terms of big projects, road building. And they've, to be fair to them, done a fairly credible job building a number of roads and highways, focusing on electrification, built power generation. So these are all good and well things, but the agenda is a domestically driven economic agenda. And there's a certain reason for it. Nigeria, with the rebasing of its GDP, has shown that it is actually Africa's largest economy. So there are reasons for this. There's been lack of attention, if you will, lack of interest in the security issues in the Niger Delta, which Lauren mentioned. Although there's a tenuous peace that's holding, the attention that was paid there a few years back has sort of dissipated. And certainly in the Northeast, where Boko Haram has been very active, the government has responded in a purely military fashion, hoping this problem can be cured very quickly and they can get back to the other business. And so I think that lack of attention is important. The other part is, let's be honest, the state where Boko Haram is most centered, Borno State, is a state that since the restoration of constitutional rule 15 years ago has been always in the hands of the political opposition. So this is not where Jonathan's base is. In fact, the ruling party hasn't won a statewide race in that state for 15 years. I'm not saying that they're neglecting the population, but they're certainly, it's not their core constituency. And that has to factor into this. And then finally, there's the question of Nigeria's pride. Because it's the largest economy, it's the most populous country in Africa as well, there's a certain sense that they don't need the world to tell them what to do. They can fix their own problems. They just have to buy the right equipment, the right video cameras, the right drones, the right everything, and they can solve on their own. So there's a great reluctance to admit that they need a little bit of help from the outside.
J. Peter Pham, director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He and Lauren Plock Blanchard, an Africa analyst at the Congressional Research Service, part of the U.S. Library of Congress, spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look for Encounter under the Programs tab. United Nations Refugee Agency reporting that thousands of people have fled a church in the Central African Republic, the capital there, in the aftermath of a lethal attack last week. UNHCR says at least 17 internally displaced people were killed, 27 others reportedly abducted by the assailants. Lisa Schlein reporting now from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
At the time of the attack, 9,000 internally displaced people were sheltering at Notre Dame de Fatima in Bangui. Now the Catholic Church is totally empty. The UN Refugee Agency describes the attack as one of the worst on any IDP site in Bangui since the Muslim Seleka group was removed from power in January. Spokeswoman Fatimata Lejeune Kaba says insecurity in the CAR capital has increased drastically since Sunday, with several fatal attacks reported. She says intercommunal hostilities culminated with the attack on Notre Dame de Fatima this week. She says this attack may mark a turning point, as until now, churches, monasteries, and mosques largely have been safe havens for people forced to flee their homes throughout the country. She notes 32 out of 43 IDP sites in Bangui are religious institutions.
Those who fled from Notre Dame de Fatima have either moved to the surrounding neighborhoods or southwards towards 10 sites in Bangui and the adjacent area of Bimbo. Many fled without anything, no money, no food, not even a mat to sleep on. Others had bullet wounds that need to be attended to urgently. Compounding their hardship, the overcrowded IDP sites they moved to face shortages in water, food, shelter, and basic health care.
Lejeune Kaba says violence continues outside the capital in other parts of CAR. She says Muslim ex-Seleka groups were behind bloody clashes that erupted in the town of Bambari last week. Unlike that situation, where the identity of the assailants is known, she says nobody knows who attacked the church in Bangui. She tells VOA that most Muslims have left the country, so Christian anti-Baleka groups which have been attacking them have lost their main target.
What we had noticed then in the change of trends is that the violence still continued within IDP sites by the anti-Baleka on Christians, so it's not religiously motivated. But it seems like that they have arms, and they use that power over IDPs to get whatever they want. But it's becoming more criminal.
The UNHCR spokeswoman says most, if not all, of the civilians in the IDP site near the airport in Bangui are Christians. Despite this, she says they are being attacked, abused, arbitrarily arrested, and abducted for ransom by anti-Baleka elements. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
To mark World No Tobacco Day over the weekend, the World Health Organization called on governments to raise taxes on tobacco. WHO says this is the most effective way to reduce smoking and to prevent the premature death of millions of people. Tobacco use is the world's leading preventable cause of death. The World Health Organization says that reporting tobacco kills nearly 8 million people a year. This includes more than 600,000 non-smokers who are dying from breathing in other people's smoke. The coordinator of WHO's Tobacco Control Economics Unit, Ida Yarecki, says evidence shows that raising taxes not only saves lives, but generates significant revenue for governments.
So these are the win-win policies for public health and the economy. According to WHO, a global 50% increase in taxes on cigarettes would lead to 49 million fewer smokers and save 11 million lives. One of WHO's highest priorities in tobacco control is to prevent young people from starting to use tobacco. And such tax increases can prevent 11 million young people from becoming smokers.
World Health Organization cites tax increases as the most effective among a number of tobacco control measures. Other measures include the establishment of smoke-free environments, health warnings on cigarette packages, and a ban on all forms of advertising, promotion, and sponsorship of tobacco products. One last story. The privately owned space exploration technologies company, also known as SpaceX, has unveiled a new manned spacecraft that could provide the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, a cheaper, more versatile way to put people in space. SpaceX Chief Executive Officer Elon Musk said the new spacecraft would help break Russia's current monopoly on space launches. Since the space shuttle fleet retired in 2011, NASA has depended on Russian rockets to transport transport astronauts to the International Space Station and back. NASA has said it wants U.S. companies to fill the void by the year 2017 and has doled out seed money to spur innovation. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. You know, you can also find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. And we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On June 2nd, 455, the Germanic tribe known as the Vandals entered Rome and plundered the city for 2 weeks. This led to the use of the term vandalism to describe senseless destruction or defacement. In 1835, showman and promoter P.T. Barnum opened his first exhibition on New York City's Broadway. It featured an elderly black woman posing as the 160-year-old former nanny of George Washington. Barnum would ultimately join such oddities with animals, clowns, and acrobats into a circus spectacular that came to be known as the greatest show on earth. In 1882, Italian nationalist and freedom fighter Giuseppe Garibaldi died, known as the hero of two worlds for his military exploits in South America and Europe. Garibaldi was instrumental in Italian unification, realized in 1871. On this day in 1896, Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi filed for a British patent for his wireless radio telegraph. In 1886, the first and only White House marriage of a sitting president of the United States occurred when Grover Cleveland married Frances Folsom. At age 21, she was the youngest first lady ever. In 1919, anarchists set off bombs in 8 U.S. cities. The attacks were part of a series of bombings that year by a group promoting communism. One of the near casualties was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who lived across the street from one of the targets. In 1924, the U.S. Congress voted to grant citizenship to all American Indians born within U.S. territory. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Clean Tech Challenge Mexico is Latin America's top green business plan competition. Each year since 2010, Mexican innovators have submitted their green ideas and business plans to implement them. After 6 months of elimination rounds, 8 finalists present their project proposals to a group of judges. The ultimate winner receives $25,000 in cash as well as other benefits. But more importantly, over the last 4 years, Clean Tech Challenge has become an open forum for investors, entrepreneurs, government, and development entities to share ideas on developing, financing, and implementing clean technology. The program is funded by some 50 private, public, and non-governmental organizations, including the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the Inter-American Development Bank, the UN Industrial Development Organization, and the Mexican government. And it is an extraordinarily successful program. It has led to the creation of new startup companies, high-quality green jobs, and an enhanced entrepreneurial culture in Mexico. It absolutely matters that the Clean Tech Challenge in Mexico has produced nearly 200 clean technology businesses. It matters that the Clean Tech Challenge has created more than 2,500 green jobs. It matters that the hundreds of companies that are engaged in this competition are on track to slash nearly 22 million metric tons of CO2, greenhouse gases, over the next 5 years, said Secretary of State John Kerry as he helped kick off the final round of the 2014 Clean Tech Challenge. USAID is a very proud sponsor of the Clean Tech Challenge, and our challenge is clear. In the past, we used to trade together. Today, due to trade relationships, we build together. In the future, we want to innovate and invent together. and we believe in the possibilities of a Mexico-U.S. strength with respect to that. If any nation has an ability to be able to drive towards that horizon, we believe it is Mexico, he said. This is how we have a chance to define the future, and this is how Mexico and the United States can do it together, by innovating, conserving, and educating. This is one big challenge.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.